From Altoona to Gettysburg, Harrisburg to Westchester, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, in a stunning rebuke to Governor Tom Wolf, a U.S. district judge has ruled the governor's shutdown orders and gathering limits are clear violations of constitutional rights. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here for a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion on the impact of the ruling. And it has been 40 years since the regulatory procedures governing rates for the freight rail industry have been updated. I'll have a town hall commentary on why it's time for the Surface Transportation Board to make some changes. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. With just a couple of weeks remaining for folks to register to vote in the upcoming presidential election, Republicans have surged ahead of Democrats in terms of new registrants. In the past 4 years since Donald Trump carried Pennsylvania, the GOP has registered 7 times more new voters than have Democrats. Overall, Republican voter registration has increased by 198,000 voters, while Democrats have added about 29,000 new voters. Trump carried Pennsylvania in 2016 by less than 50,000 votes, so the leap in Republican registrants could prove pivotal in the upcoming general election. Speaking of which, counties were supposed to begin sending out ballots for mail-in and absentee ballot voting this past week, but none were able to do so on the first day. Media reports indicate lawsuits and potential election law changes have hindered the efforts of county election bureaus. Among the unsettled issues, a challenge by the Democratic Party seeking to prevent the Green Party's presidential candidate from appearing on the general election ballot. Governor Wolf and Republican legislators are at odds over potential changes to the timetable for counting mail-in ballots and other issues, creating uncertainty for the election process, which should now be underway. Add in the fact most counties are using new electronic voting systems for those who go to the polls on Election Day, and concerns are rising that the chaos that ensued after the June primary election may repeat itself in November, this at a time when Pennsylvania is seen as a key battleground state in the presidential election. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. In a landmark ruling that declared much of Governor Tom Wolf's draconian shutdown policies resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic to have been unconstitutional, U.S. District Judge William Stickman IV says constitutional rights are absolute and cannot be violated even during a pandemic. Here to discuss the impact of the ruling, our Capitol Watch crew, David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, Rebecca Euler from the National Federation of Independent Business, and Matt Briette from Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. In the studio, your Capitol Watch All-Stars, Rebecca Euler, Legislative Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Great to be here again, David. Thank you.
And my main man, Matt Briette, CEO of Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. Matt?
David, Rebecca, good to be with you too.
So the constitutional crisis continues, and I was thinking, actually, I think this is constitutional crisis 3, the wrath of Stickman, that the federal judge for the Western District of Pennsylvania handed down a ruling declaring Governor Wolf's ad hoc emergency decree and business closure order to be unconstitutional. So, Rebecca, why don't you give us the highlights of what we saw from that?
Well, okay, it was a pretty scathing opinion on what the actions the governor has taken over the past couple of months. It basically overturned his congregate limits, the limits on the number of people who can congregate in large groups. So that's the limits of 25 indoors and 250 out of doors. That was found to violate the First Amendment right of assembly. The stay-at-home orders that the governor had issued early in this declaration and the business closures were found to violate the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And lastly, the business closures themselves and the arbitrary waiver process that the governor implemented to enforce them was found to violate the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. So it really was a strike down of a lot of the governor's actions over the past couple months. And the judge found them to be egregious. The one word that he used throughout was unprecedented. He used that word, I found, at least three or four times to refer to the actions that the governor had taken were unprecedented, not only in the state, but in the nation and in the history of the nation, unprecedented violations of constitutional rights.
And Matt, you know, I hate being right. I really do. But for listeners of this program, these are the very same points, the very same themes that we have been talking about now for months.
Yes.
Indeed. So William Stickman, Judge William Stickman, really stuck it to Governor Wolf. Sorry, had to play it that way. But in his opinion, is a 66-page opinion. This got us up and cheering, where a judge is looking at the Constitution and analyzing actions of a public official and comparing it with the limitations on government. Because so often judges are looking at, well, how can we justify these actions? And I think that there are some statements that are worth quoting.
Please.
From Stickman. First of all, he said, look, there were good intentions here, right, of trying to address a public health emergency. But he said that the government overstepped its bounds. And this is a quote. He said, even in an emergency, the authority of government is not unfettered. The liberties protected by the Constitution are not fair weather freedoms in place when times are good, but able to be cast aside in times of trouble. And that's ultimately what is so important about our Constitution, is that it transcends these difficult times, and that while we might want to empower a governor, an executive, a president, we have these limitations for a reason. And it's so that you don't have these usurpations, these grabs of power, that ratchet effect, right, that we've always seen where governments tend to take advantage of crises and take away people's freedom.
Yes.
And Stickman was noting this, and that this is an important step to curtail that ratcheting effect of giving the executive of Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Wolf, powers that override the constitutional protections of our freedoms and our liberties.
You would expect that there would be a recognition that ours is a system of checks and balances, multiple branches of government, multiple levels of government, that there's give and take, that nobody gets everything they want all the time. The governor responded to this, and he was defiant that he will not obey the court order, that he's going to appeal the ruling, and furthermore, that he tried to blame the president and the General Assembly for our current circumstances. I would expect that a leader would have the kind of wisdom and circumspect to recognize the importance of these other counterbalancing institutions in our constitutional order. And it's just like Tom Wolf just doesn't.
Well, this is a governor that has been handed victories by the Democratic-controlled Supreme Court.
State Supreme Court.
State Supreme Court that has a 5-2 majority elected by the trial lawyers and unions that have twisted the law in order to, well, overturn congressional district lines, to giving the governor unilateral power to declare these states of emergency without any true check and balance from the legislative branch. He's been able to do these things without real checks and balances. And here you have a federal judge calling him on it. I don't think he liked it too much.
And so now it's going to be appealed, and that means it goes to the Third Circuit.
Well, some of the things that were revealed in this, David, I think are important. First of all, this was filed on behalf of four counties. It had hairdressers and people that are just the average working people that were harmed by Governor Wolf's shutdown. The ruling said that, you know, there was just a uniform application of these restrictions, irrespective of the impact of COVID upon counties. So a county that was being savaged by COVID, however you want to define that, had restrictions placed on it. Let's say a county that had zero cases of COVID was just being shut down. And so that uniform, this judge found that this was an unfair application. But I think there's also something that we found that was discovered in this case was a secret agreement that was made with the Carlisle Fairgrounds that was being litigated. But it was clear that Governor Wolf was going to lose the litigation that they brought against the Carlisle Fairgrounds. And they kept the agreement secret that was permitting one particular entity to exceed the restrictions placed on everybody else. So there was another ununiform application of their restrictions, showing that this was so arbitrary and that when they're called down on it, they were making secret deals behind closed doors and not applying those to everybody else.
And this whole thing is just infuriating. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from NFIB Pennsylvania and Matt Briette from Commonwealth Partners. So, Rebecca, one of the things that I wanted to bring up was about this business closure order that Governor Wolf issued on March 19 with no warning, no input from the stakeholders, basically just ordering the economy, the entire Pennsylvania economy, to be shut down within hours. And of course, this was outrageously unreasonable. It didn't extrapolate or think through all the different permutations, and that the governor didn't follow the available federal guidelines, which were adopted by most states. Just the destructive results of this blanket shutdown order, like, it's still reverberating. It's destroyed so many small businesses.
Yes. The judge called it shockingly arbitrary. Shockingly arbitrary. And I think getting to how the decisions were made about which businesses were to shut down. The judge went into great detail in the opinion about who made these decisions. You know, there was a group of policy, which is called the group of policy planners who met in the governor's office, who he pointed out had no health experience, and I'm willing to bet no business experience. I think we probably can agree on that. But it was a group of policy advisors that met. The governor never met in person with these advisors, but that small group of elite policy advisors were the ones that made all the decisions. They went down the list and decided which ones they believed were essential or life-sustaining and which ones were not. So that was just the start of it, of course, because then we had the ever-changing list. After that, there was, the judge points out that there was no real definition of what life sustaining is. So nobody could, you know, point to the definition and say, yes. Oh, well, I'm definitely life sustaining because I fit this definition. Mm-hmm. That wasn't there.
Not only was a standard not consistently applied, there was no consistent standard to apply.
That's right. So then we all had to rely on the list. So there was a list that was put out. That list changed 10 times. The judge points out 10 times. And it even continued to change after they closed the waiver process, which was the only way that businesses could appeal the decision about whether they were life-sustaining or not life-sustaining. And the waiver process was also arbitrary. The decision goes into that a bit. But the other thing I thought, which was great about this opinion, is it pointed out directly that the largest businesses were able to stay open during this disaster, even though they sold many of the same products that small businesses sold. And those small businesses could not be open because the governor's office made that decision. So that is a pure equal protection problem. You have businesses that are similarly situated. And like you said, David, the result of these decisions that were made is that many of those businesses are no longer in business. And that's the result we have to deal with now. Or they're still struggling to try to deal with business. The judge also pointed out that it's a fundamental right of citizens to support themselves through their chosen work. And I thought that was a really important observation. It is a constitutional right for you to be able to go to work and earn your own living. And he said that was taken away arbitrarily from people in this state in the governor's orders.
And how do you compensate for that? Well, and I mean, the worst part, of course, is that Governor Wolf is out there saying that we need federal government help because these businesses, he said, have been hammered. But it's Governor Wolf who's been hammering them.
Yes. Correct. And continuing to try to suffocate them by refusing to give them the lifeline of being open enough to have a revenue stream from satisfying customers, which is the only way these businesses are going to stay alive. And it just it takes me to the next point that I wanted to bring up, which is that even in our own state government, there are supposed to be checks and balances on these things, and that one of the checks is between the legislative and the executive branch. Well, the legislature issued subpoenas, which the governor has shrugged off. And again, I'm not a lawyer, but I never thought that subpoenas were optional. And then in the absence of responding to these legislative subpoenas, that you have the auditor general who is supposed to review these things. And actually, Pennsylvania's auditor general, Eugene DePasquale, he said that he was going to do this back in April. And he did lots of media in early May about how he was going to review all this and set everything right. Well, there's no report yet. And in the interim, DePasquale, who's running for Congress, has taken political money from Tom Wolf and his wife, that Governor Wolf has headlined fundraisers for the Auditor General. And you know what? This long wait, months and months, 5 months and more with no report, it looks a lot like a stall. Yeah. To me. And so, you know, we have called on the Auditor General to recuse himself. Just stand down. We have lost confidence in you. Hand this over to your professional staff. Get out of the way and let them expedite this so the people of Pennsylvania can actually see what happened. Because to this very moment in time, we don't know who these people are who made decisions. We don't know who was denied a waiver. We don't know what criteria was used. We don't know if they used this occasion to punish political foes or to reward campaign contributors. Like, these are all things that we deserve to have answers to, but the people who were supposed to be doing this job, DePasquale, have abdicated that responsibility.
Well, this is where you have a governor who has claimed to be the most transparent, the least transactional. I mean, he won't even take a bottle of water at an event because he doesn't want to give the appearance that he's being bought off by a bottle of water. Yet this has become the least transparent and clearly a transactional governor when it comes to how we know these waivers were done. We still don't know answers to these questions. Right-to-know requests are still not being answered entirely. I mean, this is the most opaque governor administration ever. I mean, just without doubt.
Yeah, and let the record show, I know we've said it before on this program, but I want to say it again right now. The governor directly ordered the Office of Open Records to be closed, and that on those days when it was closed, those days would not count towards the legal number of days allowed for requests to be answered. So for a governor who deliberately closed and kept closed for many months the Office of Open Records, for him to pretend that somehow he is an ethical or transparent leader, it's simply not so.
Even in the face of, we know, legislation sitting on the governor's desk as we talk right now, that an overwhelming majority support of the House and Senate to allow school districts to make decisions. He talked about, we can't give that unilateral power to school districts, and intends to veto this. That's his intention. We'll see if he does it. But I sure hope that the House and Senate Democrats and Republicans empower their local school districts to make these decisions and strip this governor, who has become clearly power hungry.
No, I think his quote was more along the lines of, we can't allow one person to have that amount of power. I think that's what he
irony.
Actually said.
Yes, yes,
right.
Yes.
The irony, the hypocrisy, the
right.
Yeah.
Unreal. And yet lightning does not strike him. So now we have to prepare for whatever the next phase of this is going to be, either in terms of trying to reopen the economy, to reestablish the balance of power between the legislative and the executive, and also the status of this ruling. So I know that the General Assembly has passed legislation that will need to be passed again in the next session to change our constitution to claw back some of these excessive emergency powers that Tom Wolf has abused. But what are other pending steps that people should be taking a look at?
Well, I think that we know we have a budget that has to be completed by the end of November, and that we know the power of the purse strings. And the legislative branch can utilize that as a way to curtail, rein in a rogue governor who has been able to make declarations, issue edicts without consulting the legislature, and they should make him pay for that. They should reclaim their co-equal branch status by utilizing the budgetary process going forward. And that way, I think that's the biggest challenge and opportunity they have to restore the balance of power between the legislative and executive branch that Governor Wolf has run roughshod over.
And I hope that the legislators are up for the fight that's ahead, because it's a fight that we all need them to win if we're going to reestablish balance and through that the integrity of our constitutional order of representative self-government.
Indeed.
So anyway, that's all the time we have for this week. So good to be with you folks. And Matt, where can the listeners go to learn more about you and your group and the things that you're doing?
The best place is to go to facebook.com/Commonwealth Partners.
Okay. Rebecca, where can people find you?
They can find us at nfib.com/PA or on Facebook or Twitter.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. From Matt, Rebecca, and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Along with taxes, government regulations have a significant impact on the ability of private businesses to compete and to earn a fair return on investment. The Trump administration has moved aggressively to provide regulatory relief in many areas. One sector in which the regulatory policy should be updated is the nation's freight rail industry, which is laboring under a revenue adequacy formula that has not changed since it was set up 40 years ago. Back in the 1980s, Congress passed the Staggers Rail Act, which lifted federal price controls on the freight rail industry with the goal of allowing markets to set the rates. To ensure the industry would not abuse the markets to achieve excessive profits, the legislation put into place a revenue adequacy formula to be calculated and enforced by the Surface Transportation Board, or STB. The impact of freight rail deregulation has been dramatic. According to a report from the Hoover Institution, freight rail rates fell by 45% due to competition and increased efficiencies by the industry. As a result, the average rail shipper can ship almost double the amount of freight today for the same equalized price as it did in the 1980s. In the years since passage of the Staggers Act, private freight rail companies have made a significant investment in infrastructure. The companies average a combined $25 billion in annual expenditures to maintain and modernize rail networks, and that investment is made with private, not public, dollars. It is important that the freight rail industry has an updated revenue adequacy formula so that it can continue to make these investments. Such investments are needed primarily to ensure the ability of freight rail to compete with other modes of transportation and to prevent delays in shipments and deliveries. There are significant public safety and environmental benefits as well. Private capital investment in freight rail infrastructure means deteriorating bridges and tracks are repaired or replaced. Unsafe crossings in populated areas are upgraded, and technology is deployed to prevent derailments and other accidents. Freight rail is ahead of other modes of transportation in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and it is a highly efficient utilizer of fuel. For example, U.S. freight railroads can move one ton of freight more than 470 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. So with all of these benefits and a robust freight rail industry serving the American consumer, why is there a need for regulatory change? First, rather than determine if railroads have earned adequate revenue in the past, STB policy should be forward-looking to what the industry needs to continue to attract capital, pay for capacity upkeep, and expand to meet the nation's transportation needs. The current formula of measuring revenue adequacy year by year does not take into account annual business fluctuations. One good year could be followed by one or more bad years, thus the need for adequacy to be forward-looking. Revenue adequacy should be determined by comparing the freight rail industry's performance to other companies in the S&P 500. The STB would have a more accurate view of railroads' actual financial health if its determinations incorporated information on whether railroad return on investment over the cost of capital was in line with peer companies competing for investment dollars. How the STB calculates constantly changing federal tax policy into their revenue adequacy formula, especially its treatment of deferred taxes, also needs to be updated. The STB's congressional mandate is to help railroads earn a, quote, reasonable and economic profit or return, or both, on capital employed in the business, end quote. In other words, private freight rail companies, like any other privately owned company, have a right to set prices in a manner that allows a reasonable profit. The STB is also charged with not allowing excess profits, but after 40 years, the time has come to revisit how revenue adequacy is determined. This will allow for continued investment to meet future demand, which is expected to rise by 35% over the next 20 years. For states like Pennsylvania, which boast a healthy manufacturing sector, continued access to freight rail for the receipt of raw materials and the shipment of finished products is essential. It is important, then, that federal regulators make the necessary adjustments to not only fulfill their congressional mandate, but to ensure this vital sector of our economy remains vibrant and competitive. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. And if you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. We invite you to join us for the 2020 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, which will be held virtually this Friday and Saturday, September 25th and 26th. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will originate live from the Radisson Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill, beginning at noon on Friday. It can be viewed on the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference Facebook page, the conference's YouTube channel, and will be webcast at paleadershipconference.org. The conference will also be aired live on the Pennsylvania Cable Network. A complete agenda and speaker list can be found at paleadershipconference.org. You are also urged to register at no charge to receive the conference app so you can receive real-time information as the conference proceeds. Again, complete information on the virtual 2020 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference taking place this Friday and Saturday can be found at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
We'll be right back.